Hello everybody and welcome to the next episode of Blog Tales. My name is Katharina Zeuch, I'm the founder of Lunar Vision, and today I have with me Oliver Shantin. Oliver, so nice that you're here.
Yeah, thanks. I'm glad to be here. One of the few males who are allowed here. So yeah, I'm very honored. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's not just a few males, but we try to focus more on women. But we want to give an platform to everyone who has an interesting Web3 story. So maybe you can introduce yourself a bit.
Oh yeah, sure. So my name is Oliver. I'm founder and CEO of Basenode.io, which is a accounting and invoicing platform for cryptocurrencies. And my original background was in industrial engineering, actually the same background you have, Katharina. I studied in University of Hamburg, and back in 2016, I fell into the blockchain and Bitcoin rabbit hole, and I knew I had to work in this area, so that's why I decided to start working at a blockchain research center back then at the university, which was pretty cool. I got to develop some prototypes for like smart city projects and so on, but in the end, it was not that much of a blockchain focus at this facility. So I decided to become my own boss and started founding a startup. Back then in 2019 was my first startup idea, which was an e-learning platform for banks to bring blockchain knowledge to banks. That never really took off. So I learned a lot. I mean, I think the company even still exists today, but I left the company, learned a few lessons, and then I started again in 2021 with Basenode, which is my job up until this day. So there's a little bit of my background story.
Okay, let's get back to the entrepreneur part later again. But first, that we now know who you are, our first question. How would you explain your everyday Web3 life to your grandma?
Oof, yeah, I knew that question would come. So I would say something like, my job is to make complicated technology very simple to use for the average user. So this is something I try to do in my job. Yeah.
Okay, sounds pretty meta actually, because it's not connected to anything accounting, crypto, whatever. But yeah, I think your grandma might understand.
Like,
this,
when
right?
I start explaining crypto to my grandma, I try to keep it on like a high level, so I don't have to explain too much I imagine talking to my grandma right now, so I don't start like, oh yeah, I'm building user interfaces and stuff like that. Yeah.
Is there an underlying thought on your side that you think people in the age of your grandma will not understand crypto at all, ever?
No, I wouldn't generalize it like that. But I know that my grandma doesn't understand it, so that's why. In general, crypto, the whole crypto space, and especially Bitcoin, is more attractive to like Generation Y, Generation X even. You even have people from the boomer generation who are very much into the space, which is cool, but the majority is probably a little bit younger and not the age of my grandma. So yeah, you can generalize it a little bit maybe, but I'm always careful with stuff like that.
Understood. So let's get back to you and let's talk less about your grandma. What actually made you become interested in the blockchain technology, you said back in 2016.
Yeah, so back in 2016 was when I first started to understand Bitcoin. My first touch point was way earlier, back in 2012, when I read about Bitcoin in some online forum. But back then, of course, I thought it was a scam because, it looks like a scam when you first see it. I can't blame people who are like, oh yeah, this Bitcoin thing and will go to zero. It's like a scam. Of course, if you spend like half an hour or even just a few hours studying it, it definitely looks like a scam, and it looks so similar to stuff that has already died in the past. So yeah, I can't really blame people for being skeptic in the beginning. But back then in 2016, I had some time on my hand, and I started researching and learning about it. And you, after a few hours of time invest into Bitcoin, you just cross a point where there's no return, you know, where you start getting dragged into the rabbit hole. And that's what happened to me. And I don't regret it.
But I think this is very interesting. Why do you think that it's reasonable that people think Bitcoin is a scam? So what in your eyes makes this appear like a scam?
Yeah. So usually when you first see or hear about Bitcoin, your first touch point, your first assumption is that there's a company behind this, right? So for example, I was explaining Bitcoin at Deutscher Erbrechtstag. I was a speaker at this event where there were a lot of lawyers, not like young lawyers, but like mostly lawyers that are really that have settled in their field. They are very experienced, and they wanted to learn a little bit about blockchain and about Bitcoin. And I had like a whole presentation about it, and they were quite interested in it. But then in the end, after the presentation, one of the lawyers approached me. Was like an older guy. And he asked me, yeah, but if I buy Bitcoin, like what, like who is producing the Bitcoins? Like what company is behind this? Like, so the very basic thought that there is no entity, no company behind it. It's not a business. It's something that emerged through a grassroots movement, basically through the people, right? You could say something that was discovered, not really invented. This is really hard to grasp, and it was really hard to grasp for me in the beginning too. So in the beginning you think, okay, when I buy a Bitcoin, someone produces this Bitcoin, sells it to me for X thousand euros. So I'm just giving money to some scammer or to some kind of entity who is, getting rich. So this takes a lot of time to realize that it's not like that.
What made it then? Like, what was the thing that convinced you that it's not a scam? What made you, let's say, believe in it, if you want to phrase it like that?
So it sounded a little bit too good to be true to me. So I was like, I was aware of the problem that we have with our money system that is currently being used, the fiat money system. So I was already interested back then in economics. I was I was having classes in my studies, because when you study industrial engineering, you also get classes on macroeconomics, you get classes on all these topics, and you learn about the central bank and how it works. And I was always like, well, something doesn't seem right with our money. Like there's something off, but I couldn't put my finger on it. So when I learned about Bitcoin, I was like, oh yeah, this has actually all the qualities that I would want for a sound money, but it always sounded too good to be true to me. I was like, yeah, but there must be a catch. Like something must be an attack vector that we didn't think of and stuff like that. But the more you learn, the more you trust in mathematics and in this whole system. So that would be my answer.
So basically, I guess you took some time to understand the mathematics and also the technology behind it, like understanding what's a hash value, how do you calculate it, what's a private and public key. I don't know, as you're an industrial engineer, did you ever, for example, read about the paper from Diffie-Hellman, how they first created a public and private key infrastructure, or did you not?
I didn't read the paper, but I definitely got into all that theory, because all the puzzle pieces that Satoshi put together, they were there before, right? So it's we knew proof of work before, we knew in theory, how to store data securely, but putting all these pieces back together in like in this way that Satoshi did was the thing that was really revolutionary. The same way that Steve Jobs put together the iPhone, which I see behind you. So all these components, right? We have the lithium battery, we have a display, a touch display, and like a microphone and all that stuff that's in the smartphone. It has been there for a long time, for years and years. But no one put them together in this way. And this is also what Satoshi did with the blockchain. So the components were there. We knew public and private key cryptography. We knew hash functions. We knew proof of work. All that stuff was there, but to combine it in this way, that was, in my opinion, a genius. Genius way to do it.
Speaking of innovation, so as an entrepreneur, I think everyone tries to innovate at least a little piece of the system, right, or of any product. And I'm very happy that you have been part of our Blocktails side event at Crypto Assets Conference a couple of weeks ago. And there you explained to our participants the Bitcoin Lightning Network. And as I recall right, you also gifted everyone there 1,000 Satoshis via Bitcoin Lightning. So do you think Bitcoin Lightning is an innovation? Or do you think it's more... or rather, the same thing in a different dress.
I think Bitcoin Lightning is one nice addition to Bitcoin. So the true innovation is the Bitcoin blockchain, and we all know the blockchain trilemma. I'm sure you're familiar with it, so you can either have a lot of security and decentralization. Or you can scale. So, and then we have different blockchain networks that go for different approaches. Yeah, if I look at Ethereum, for example, which choose to be more scalable, like more transaction per seconds, but they decided to be less decentralized and less secure. You can look at the number of Bitcoin nodes out there. You can look at the number of Ethereum nodes, and you will see, okay, there are way more Bitcoin nodes, and they are way better distributed among the planet. So some other projects made some compromise. Or you can look at really, really centralized projects like Binance Chain or like Solana, right? At some point, they process an insane amount of transactions, but they have, of course, other issues like Solana being down from time to time because it's so centralized that it becomes an attack vector at some point. So with Bitcoin and the Lightning Network, I think we can combine the high decentralization that the Bitcoin network offers with a scalability that most of the other blockchains cannot reach. Of course, there's always a compromise to be made. There's no free lunch. So if I hold Satoshis on the Lightning Network, they're not that secure like an on-chain transaction, but they're maybe good enough for like smaller amounts. So
that's what I wanted to
really
interview
nice
here.
To scale the network.
That's what I want to raise here. If you play devil's advocate on that one, then you could say, okay, you already said in the beginning that Bitcoin might be too good to be real, but a blockchain system that is then solving the complete trilemma and offering all three things, scalability, security, and speed, wouldn't this sound even more like a scam?
Yeah. So, and it is too good to be true because it's not true. So the point is that the blockchain trilemma is still valid because the Bitcoin blockchain doesn't scale well. And that's okay because its purpose is not to handle all the transactions in the world. So the trilemma is still intact, but we can add something to the Bitcoin blockchain, right? So the Lightning Network is one way of scaling by using payment channels. But there are many ways to scale, not just that. You know, I can just put some coins on a little wallet, on a USB drive, like a hardware wallet or something. And then I hand it over to the next person And suddenly I made a transaction, a Bitcoin transaction, without it being written into the blockchain. So this is also a way of scaling, right? So I can just trade peer-to-peer and hand over physical devices that contain Bitcoin, and it's another way to scale it, right? Like cash money. There are many more. There's the Liquid Network, which is building like a sidechain to the Bitcoin blockchain. And there are many attempts to scale the network. But, in the end, if you want really high security and decentralization, you have to do an on-chain transaction. And you always can fall back to the on-chain. So, in a way, we are solving the trilemma. But if you take a closer look, we are actually not solving the trilemma. We're just building a way around it.
I think this is very important to point out, actually, so that people don't get mistaken on this, because the core Bitcoin blockchain, as much as I like that, it still didn't solve the trilemma. And actually, I think everyone who gets along with somebody who tries to sell them any chain that is supposed to solve it and to have all the three things, I think then you should actually start listening very closely, because to me that would be a definite red flag, and then I would suspect a scammer to be around the corner, actually.
Yeah, probably. Have you heard of something like that? Like, did some, I don't know, some project approach you and be like, hey, we got the next big thing, we got Bitcoin, but only better, or something like that?
No, actually not. But maybe this is also because people wouldn't try, because I openly tell about that I know a bit about it. But if I would be, let's say, your grandma,
To be scammed, right?
Yes. So mm-hmm. I think there are other targets out there who are easier to be scammed in that matter than me. But I mean, that's not the only scam that's possible out there, right? And I, coming back to your entrepreneurship background, I have had you as a guest at our panel discussion about investment scammers, for example. So you also have some experience with different scams, as far as I know. So maybe let's get back to your entrepreneurship journey. So you said earlier that you decided to become your own boss. And this sounds actually pretty much like the mindset that Web3 is about, like not trusting but verifying, and not only following but being part of something, participating and working on something together. But how does it go right now? Like, how does it feel for you to be your own boss? Do you have the feeling that you are your own boss and you can actually decide everything on your own?
When you become an entrepreneur, you technically have no boss, but then again, you do have people who basically, they don't tell you what to do, but it's a different dynamic. So when you're running a company, basically your customers are your bosses, right? So you have to find ways to meet the needs of your customers. And you don't have a single person telling you, hey, you need to do this task right now, which is nice. But in the end, you have to do the task still. Like, there's no way around it. If you want to be successful, you have to work. And so I did get rid of my old boss, but then now it's not like I work less or something after that. So, but I'm sure you can tell. I mean, I'm sure you can tell from experience that you went through something similar, because I saw on your profile that you also decided to become a founder and with your marketing agency and all that, right?
Sure. Actually, I think the mistake here is to say, okay, I am becoming my own boss, and then thinking you don't have a boss, because you do. And the boss now is you. And if you have another employee, you want them to perform at their best and you want them to be efficient. So obviously you want this from all of your employees. And as you are your own employee, you want this from yourself. So I think it's a very nice thing to be the one who creates the tasks and the one who sets like the threshold for everything. But on the other hand, I also think that actually I am the most, I'm the boss. Let me rephrase this and we cut this out later. I think
no, it's good. You're the boss. I mean, I like that statement.
Yeah, I'm the boss. But on the other hand, cool. I think there's no one who would judge me more than I do myself as a boss. And this is something in entrepreneurship that I think not everyone is prepared for. And that's actually a hard lesson to learn, that being your own boss doesn't mean you don't have a boss or your clients are your own boss, but that you are the boss and you are the one who judges you.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. So you're your own strongest judge, and that's maybe even more pressure than some other boss judging your work. I mean, you can always say, oh yeah, I'm gonna change my job, I'm gonna quit my job, I'm done here, but you cannot really say that to yourself, right? So when you're your hardest judge, then you don't want to disappoint yourself, right? That's even more pressure than a regular job.
Exactly. Yes. And I think that not everyone's prepared for this, or everyone's having this in mind when becoming an entrepreneur. And I think it's very important that we also talk about the hard parts of being an entrepreneur, because everyone's always displaying it to be very shiny and very easy, because become an entrepreneur and get rich. But actually, there's a long way to go, and also a long way of growing yourself and developing yourself on the way to get a company, to found a company and to run it, and then to run it successfully.
Yeah. It's really, I wouldn't recommend it for everyone. So you need to be the right kind of person to do this. Especially here in Germany, it's not an easy path. So being an employee here at a big corporation in Germany, it's actually probably the better choice if you don't want too much trouble in your life. But if you like trouble, then go ahead and found a company, and then see what kind of letters you're getting from some officials, and what you need to prove and all that stuff. And it's a whole
story. I would say it's if you're up for trouble and if you're up for paperwork, because there's a lot of this, right?
Yeah. I have like a folder that's like, it's, I don't exaggerate, it's like my head, basically. this thick, only with paperwork, and it's only from founding a company. So it's not like bills or any other stuff. It's just founding the company, notary stuff, some stuff from like the government officials, letters that you get, and like the setup of like the tax thing and the employees, all that stuff. This big. And trust me, I tried to do everything via email that is possible, right? So everything that can be done digitally, I did digitally. This is only the must-have paperwork. And it's insane. It's crazy, because so many of these processes could be avoided, or at least put into some kind of digital form. And no, the fax machine is not a digital communication device. this is really, really strange to experience that in 2023. But I guess that's just the way it is.
For now, at least, yes.
What do you mean for
maybe
now?
We can change
to, like,
it for the future,
revolutionize,
but for now,
the German bureaucracy. Okay, I'm listening.
For now, it's the way it is. But do you think, like, I've heard from many startups in the crypto space that lately they had issues getting a bank account, or like setting up a bank account, especially with one bank that changed the name I don't want to point it out here, but do you think it's getting more difficult to found a startup in Web3 in Germany than to found a startup that's not Web3 related?
I don't really have the comparison because, yeah, the startups that I founded are all some way blockchain related. But so it wasn't easy for us to get a bank account either. We tried different banks. I don't know if I can name them here, but okay. I just tell you, in the end, we got an account with Phenom, which is like a German banking startup. I think it's a spin-off from Solaris Bank. I'm not sure. So I don't want to get it messed up. But so Phenom took us. But the other banks we tried before, they were all like, ah, no. You have something to do with cryptocurrencies. We rather not take you. And I mean, I can understand, right? I mean, it's like it's like asking a taxi driver to call you an Uber. So like most of them would say, I rather not do it, right? So, I mean.
I really like this comparison. I've never thought of it that way, but it's great to say. Getting a bank account as a Web3 startup is like calling it,
like asking a taxi driver to call you an Uber. It's like something like that.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always like that. You know, when you have like disruptive technologies, then it's hard to connect them to the legacy system that was or that is still there and handles all this stuff, right? So we still. I mean, if you take a look at our banking system, it's in my eyes, it's insane because 2 out of 7 days, we just don't do any transactions. I mean, at least for retail customers and for small companies. I don't know what, like maybe interbank transactions still happen. I don't know. But here where I live, at least it's like that. On Saturday, on Sunday, nothing happens. Like it's just like our economic system just comes to a stop. And it's like everyone is like, oh, yeah, that's fine. I mean, on Monday we continue. That's not like that's maybe that was okay like 100 years ago, but it's definitely not okay in 2023 because we have an interconnected world. Like we have globalization. We have so many people interacting and sending money and transactions. I mean, we cannot just shut it down. And the same goes for holidays. And like, what are even banking hours? Like, why does it exist? So, why can I go to get fuel in my car at the gas station 24/7. There's always a person working at the gas station, right? But why can I not send money 24/7, which is far more important in my opinion? So, yeah, something needs to change there. that's what I'm saying.
That's a very good question. I actually don't have an answer to this. Maybe we should do some research into why the banking system created a system where we have only 5 of 7 days working.
Well,
the answer would be quite interesting, I think.
I don't even know if there are actual people, like, you know, if I send you 20 euros, is there an actual human looking at the transaction and be like, yeah, okay, this is fine, I approve it? I don't think so. Like for small amounts, that would be insane, right?
I couldn't imagine, yes. I don't know. Yeah. I will do some research on this because this is really interesting. But actually, I don't know. But apparently, something has to happen with it in the meantime, right? Because if you send me a transaction today and you don't do it via like real time transaction, then it takes what two business days until the money enters my bank account. What happens in the meantime? Why does it take so long? I mean, previously it was like, okay, you filled this piece of paper where you said, okay, you want to send me 20 bucks, and then you handed it in and someone actually took the paper and put it into a computer system. So I got why it took so long back then. But by today, you click a button on your computer and what then?
Yeah, I mean, sending money should be as easy as sending a WhatsApp, right? Or sending a text message. Why is it more difficult than that? That's a question we need to ask.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer to this, but I will certainly do some research about this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I mean, probably there's a good answer to this question. But those are the things that I'm wondering about sometimes. You know, what is happening? Like, why is this so slow? Why is it closed on 2 out of 7 days? Why do we just agree and say, okay, this is good enough for like the very infrastructure that we build our economy upon? Like, we were like, oh yeah, 5 out of 7 days, that's good enough. That's a little bit like, I don't know, it's a little bit strange to see that. Maybe there's not enough competition, you know, like we have like one banking system. Like, usually when something is not as good as it could be, it's a lack of competition. That's like usually the answer. So, I mean, we have competition between banks, but they're all playing the same game, right? They're all playing in this same system. So maybe Bitcoin is at least putting a little bit of pressure on the banking system. And let's see what happens. Maybe service gets better.
I can hear the Bitcoin, the Bitcoiner coming out there again.
Right. Well, I'm not saying Bitcoin is the solution to everything, right? So the banking system is not all bad. Like, don't get me wrong. There's stuff that works well. Like, we can send money for free in, like, at least within the European Union or within the same country. It's pretty quick. It's usually there on the same day or on the next day sometimes. And it usually doesn't cost money to send it. And so it's okay. It's probably good enough or has been good enough for the longest time, but there's definitely potential to improve it. That's all I'm saying.
Okay, but we're already digging into our like second to last question here. So the banking system and why it takes so long to do a transaction via the traditional banking system is one of the topics you might get deeper into. But as we always ask, I want to ask you too, what's a topic that you would like to know more about, but you don't yet? And why is it so?
So I would love to be able to be like, I would love to be able to code. Like, I'm not a developer. I can do a little bit of coding and I mean, I'm not like a total noob, but I admire when people can just sit down and they have an idea and then they can just write code and it just works. It's like magic. That's amazing. And yeah, another topic I would love to know more about is probably AI, because I find it fascinating, but it's also a black box to me. So that's something I would love to learn more about.
Maybe this problem solves itself once AI enables you to do the black magic of coding within seconds.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, maybe one problem solves the other problem. Yeah, why not?
Yeah. Still, I don't want to hold you back to do the research to understand at least one of both a bit more. but until then, I'd say we are nearly done with the time. So I would ask you to let us know your blog tale by finishing the sentence in 30 seconds. Once upon a time.
Oh, once upon a time, a young engineer tripped and fell into the Bitcoin rabbit hole and never got out. He didn't build spaceships or cars. He started building software to make the world a better place.
Thank you so much, Oliver, for your blog tale and for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Hope to see you soon again. And to all the people out there, hope to see you in the next episode again.
Bye. Love.